My aim this morning in sharing this info is to bring awareness of what Alicia is alluding to. I was directly involved with First Nations peoples for approximately 12 years and find them to be a very kind and loving people. They have been dealt a nasty blow for many years, and it continues today. I really don't see a solution that is very evident at this point in time, but I think progress is being made, and I think we're on the right track. So I want to give you a little bit of history, and my talk is probably a bit on the negative side, and I apologize for that, but I don't really apologize for it, because that's what we're living with. We all know the specifics of 1492. Columbus supposedly discovered the Americas. But when you talk to the First Nations peoples, they were here that whole time before that, and they get quite upset with that kind of language that North America was discovered by Columbus. North America is known as Turtle Island in the First Nations, and many of the peoples travel freely between what we now know as Canada and US, and they did not recognize boundaries the way we see them. I want to talk a little bit about treaties. These were agreements made between tribes and the government. So tribes are the Algonquin, Ojibwe, Iroquois. Those are all different tribes, and there are probably, 50, 60, 100 different tribes between Canada and US. Bands are groups of Ojibwe, so there could be five Ojibwe families. That is now known as a band. We lived with a band of Ojibwe at Henvey Inlet, so there were three or four predominant families in that little band. Bands typically live in small areas within a large tribal area. And for the Ojibwe, their tribal ancestral land reaches from James Bay down to mid-US, and then from Parry Sound area, and then west to Lake Huron. So these tribes all coexisted and lived in overlapping areas. So an area could be on the fringes, there could be several different tribes working and trading within that area. And then they traded freely with each other. They did have their skirmishes. There were battles where children were stolen and forced into the new tribe as laborers, or the women as childbearing people. So that was definitely going on. The other interesting thing is that if, let's say, the Ojibwe and the Hurons had difficulties with the Iroquois, then they would get together and they would have a battle with the Iroquois. So there were lots of interactions of that nature as well. I'll talk a little bit about treaties. They were meant to be agreements between the government and tribes or bands. Now, most First Nations peoples did not know English language, nor knowledge of how the English language worked. Yet all of the treaties were written in British language or French language, and using legal jargon. They didn't have the Billy Goods in our society to interpret for them. Thanks, Bill. They didn't have that interpretation available to them. So when the British wrote their treaties, the First Nations didn't really understand what that was all about. So there were multiple verbal agreements made as well. So the British wanted the First Nations people to sign their treaties as acknowledgement in our white society that we are agreeing on this. And I have a booklet that was handed out. If anybody's interested in looking at it, we can show you. But the picture that I have in front of me, I'm quoting now, the late James Massasoit, pictured here at 104 years of age, was 9 years old when he witnessed the blind chief Daniel Misabi mark his X on the treaty. So here's a blind chief making an X on a treaty that he probably does not understand other than verbal, but he signed his signature to it. So that is now an official British document. So the other thing, yes, I mentioned that the people did not have a good English. There were also verbal agreements made. And we have just learned recently that many of these verbal agreements that were made were actually documented by the secretary who was in attendance at these treaty signings. So here's a little quote from an elder, Isaiah Wapensik. He was 61 years old, and this was in 1974. I can clearly remember when the treaty was signed in 1905. We were promised assistance for as long as the sun shines and the rivers flow. Now that's pretty definite for the length of the agreement. This is written in 1974 and signed in 1905. To this very day, I am still waiting for the things that the government promised. The other interesting thing that we've recently found out is that some of these documents that were recorded back then have recently been found in Ottawa. How they're going to be used now to compensate the whole issue with the First Nations peoples remains to be seen. Also, while we were on our medicine bundle tour, we heard a report of a community where the South African De Beers Mining Company had found diamonds on a reserve, and these diamonds were benefiting De Beers and the Canadian government, but not really benefiting the community. They continue to live in squalor. Part of the rationale for the signers of the treaties was that the British, that the natives were given the lands to live on, but were not given the rights to whatever is on the land or under the surface, i.e. mining gold, diamonds in this case, or in some cases even the timber rights. First Nations living on reserves were promised health care, schools, hunting, trapping, and fishing rights. At the time of the treaty signing, so this is in the mid-1800s, they would also receive $4 annually, and that was a life commitment. And that is one thing that the government has stuck to. When we were on the reserve, every year there was a big to-do about the government people coming and giving each individual their $4. So $4 in the 1500s could have purchased four horses Today is $4. Buys two packages of bubble gum. And that hasn't changed. So the Mounties, two Mounties would come with three people, three whites, and they would hand out the $4. And that was following the treaty. One other thing I want to say is the size of the reserves were based generally on about 160, 150 acres per family of five. So that was one of the agreements in the treaties that was made. Anyway, I have lots and lots and lots of information if anybody ever cares to hear. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Zoe Dreger, and this is my sister, Shauna Dreger. Shauna and I have been given the amazing opportunity to join the North Church team in a journey to Timmins. It was a phenomenal experience, and I believe that we both learned a lot from the trip. Something that continuously circled in my mind during the trip was that we really do have to be thankful and grateful for what we have. Throughout the trip, I was genuinely baffled by the drastic poverty on the James Bay Reserve at Awapiskat. We also ate with people who depended on community meals for the food for their days. And my gratefulness towards a fridge full of food at home was realized. Throughout the trip, Shauna had taken many videos and pictures and put the videos together into a presentation, and we would like to share it with you now.
Thank you. So that was pictures a lot were taken on our trip. You can see lots of trees and lots of driving, which we did do. But a great experience. My part of the talk, I feel really tall here. Okay. My part of the talk I'm calling Hope in the Land. And I don't know if my name's Carolyn Hamm, by the way. And I'm the mom of Zoe and Shauna Dreger. I don't know if you're aware, but I lived in northern Manitoba on an Indian reserve for 4 years when I first started teaching. I lived in a drive-in for 1 year and a fly-in for fly-in reserve for the other 3 years. So the only way to get in was either flying or an ice road in the winter. And I certainly knew what I saw when I was up there. That was, and I'm dating myself, that's okay. I started in 1978 and lived there till 1982. So 40 years ago. At that point, I think the reserve was what most people think of a reserve. Houses were not well cared for at all. Lots of plywood houses kind of slapped together. Lots of garbage everywhere around the houses, not really well cared for. There was a lot of drinking on the reserve, and a lot of kids not getting cared for properly, and that was really my feeling of the place. And we had one of our speakers, Ursula, and I have to say that I was so impressed with all of the speakers we had on this tour. Really reaffirmed that that's really what life was like for kids growing up in the reserve. And she said that she didn't want to be like that, and she changed. I didn't think I was going to do this either. And it really gave me a lot of hope that all those kids, sorry, I didn't think this was going to happen, all those kids that I taught that were growing up in such a terrible circumstance could turn their lives around and really become successful. And this is what Ursula said. She said, I saw my mom drunk on the floor, no food in the cupboard at all, and I didn't want to raise my kids that way. And it was like, I was just so happy to hear that. So when I was up there, I thought, though, we didn't do very good helping them. We moved in and we kind of, like the reserve I was on called South Indian Lake, they built a dam and they flooded all their trap lines. So that's like someone building a dam and flooding all your farmland and giving you a little patch to live on. And then $4 a year. And we saw they would line up every year for their $4, every single person, man, woman, and child, and how degrading, would line up and they'd get their $4. Yeah, that was in 1977, which was ridiculous back then, and they're still doing it now. And this is what the government is calling fair. And I'll just say as well, every one of those speakers, and they were brilliant people, got up and said exactly the same thing. What person in their right mind would sign a treaty like that? And we all know that, but we just haven't said it out loud. Like, they take away all of their rights to the lands, they give them a postage stamp to live on, and they signed that with understanding it, and what they thought is they said, we're gonna share this land. Sure, we'll share it with you. And that's not what we did at all. We took it away and gave them a tiny little place to live on. So, but when I was up there, I realized we didn't do very good helping them. We gave them welfare, and then they didn't have their need to work anymore. We took away their pride. So helping them, we thought we were helping them. You need money to live on. We're going to give you this. We're going to give you that. We didn't help them. I really thought the only way that this is going to work is that they step up and they fix it themselves, because they know what they need, and we don't know what they need. And I saw that, and that's why I called this part of the talk Hope, because there is so much hope now. I was sitting at the table with Zoe and Shauna, and this lady comes and sits with us, and she looked, I mean, I thought she was Native. She looked dressed normal and, yeah, nice hair and all that stuff. But anyway, we're talking, and all of a sudden, Ben leaves over and says, is that Teresa Spence? So Teresa Spence was in the media like crazy at the beginning of the Idle No More movement. She was the one that did the she did the fast, the starvation, to bring light to that. And she's sitting at our table having coffee with us. It was like, whoa, like major brush with fame. It was so cool. And she got up, and honestly, I was so impressed with her. She knows what they need. Like, they know what they need, and they're taking over, and they're doing it. And every speaker got up and said the same thing. She said, we've got our lawyers, we've got our doctors, we've got our teachers. We know what we need, and we can do it. You just have to listen to us, and we need to renegotiate with us, because that was really not a fair deal you gave us. I was so, so impressed. We had a speaker that was reclaiming her belief system, but also the medicines, the native medicines that they were doing. And they showed her there, they were doing a smudge ceremony in the video where they had, they use sage, they burn it, and then you use it to cleanse your mind, cleanse your heart. And you saw her there. She actually is Jamaican. Her dad was Jamaican, and her mom was indigenous. So not all indigenous people look the same, so that was kind of cool to see her. But what everybody acknowledged at the same time is they lost a whole generation. They lost a generation because of drinking, but they're reclaiming it again, and they're going back, and they're having to go and try to find all that information and rebuild their lives because of that. We went to a reserve that was two hours outside of Timmins, and I think I was expecting what I saw up north, to tell the truth, and did not see that at all. The houses were clean, and the siding was new, and people were building decks on their back porch, and the community center was in the video as well. It was modern and clean, and they had administrative offices and boardrooms and a kitchen, and they made us this beautiful fish meal. And it was just so good. Like, it was just like, they're making it. They're really, you know, doing well. And I think both Ben and I were just so happy and surprised to see such good things happening on the reserve. And it's not a shame to call it a reserve anymore. I didn't get that sense at all. It used to be, oh, I live on the reserve, it's a terrible thing. And it just didn't get that sense at all that it's bad to be on the reserve. So that was so cool. You need to balance that with the Attawapiskat experience. So that's the one that Zoe mentioned. It's the reserve outside of that diamond mine on James Bay. And so De Beers gives our Canadian government, I think it was $5 billion for taking mines out of our province. And the people living on Attawapiskat is identical to everything I saw. I was on the reserve 40 years earlier. So there's still not stuff that's really not fair and not right happening in Ontario. People without running water, using buckets for toilets, no food in the fence. People, you know, saying this is horrible, this is a shitty place to live. All the kids living in these situations. There was a mom living in a lean-to, and she said she put a window in it. She was in there with her husband and four kids, and they had to put a window in it because the kids go around burning things, and she was afraid they would burn it down when she and the kids were inside. And this is Ontario, living a few miles away from a diamond mine that's making a lot more than $5 billion because that's what they're giving the Canadian government. So there's still lots going on that we need to work on. We're not done, obviously, but the reserve we saw called Matagami was amazing. So I was so impressed. And then we drove down, so we were questioning, like, what's going on? Like, how come it's so much better in Matagami? Is it the same everywhere? So we actually took a side tour, and we went to Ben and Arlene's reserve that they lived on for 12 years. I think we came back in 2008, I think, something like that. And the reserve was the same. Like, actually, the worst house was the house that you guys lived in. Like, they were clean. They were there was no garbage around them. Clean siding. You could see real pride in the entire reserve. Like, it was Like, I think Ben was really surprised how good it was. He said, when you guys lived there, that was the worst house on the reserve, and now it's the, I mean, it was the best house on the reserve, and now it's by far the worst. Everybody's, they are turning around, and they are doing better. I think, though, so I think one thing, I think our job is to stand beside them and help them do what they know they need to do. And I think that's our job, not tell them what to do, because we truly don't know what to do, but they do. And then the second thing, I think we can learn a lot, and even as Mennonites specifically, we can learn a lot, because we too have been through trauma in our lives, and I think we don't appreciate the trauma that the Mennonites went through when they first came from Russia. But they're not mad. And I think that was the most amazing thing that I saw there, is they aren't angry at us for being white and taking away their land and all that stuff. They just want to move on. They just want to, they want to work with us. They were so grateful that we came up and listened to them. Every single one of them said, thank you so much for listening. And they're not mad. They have this grace about them that is so beautiful that I know, even personally, I'm going to try to learn from that, and learn that if someone does you wrong, you don't try to get revenge, you don't try to go back, you just move on. And really, this is just what I saw them doing. I think they truly are models of survivorship, what is what we saw happening. So it was very exciting for me to see all that happening. And I just want to say it again, I think it is our job to stand by them and support them. Thank you.
To close our sharing, I'd like to read a passage from Micah. God has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God.
As part of our summer series on Sabbath, we want to include a moment of silence.